She thought she might have to do something rare for her, reconsider her opinion. This was no France wannabe. This was genuine Quebec, with its own history etched into flesh and bone, into stone and wood, into the cushions of the armchairs and sofas, retaining the impressions of warm bodies who'd sat there before her, eating, talking, commiserating, laughing, for generations. This was no imitation, but the real thing. By the time Clara found her, Dominica had enjoyed a glass of red wine and a delicious buttery Riopel de Lille, a cheese made on a tiny Quebec island and named after one of her favourite artists, Jean-Paul Riopel. Dominica hadn't realised that the abstract expressionist painter came from Quebec and lived, worked, and died on a small island. She smeared the cheese on a baguette fresh from the bakery next door and looked at the village framed by the mullioned windows. She was wondering how much homes around the village green cost and if any of her subscribers would notice or care if she decamped to Canada. Though, looking at Clara Morrow's face, she knew one person who might not be pleased. Vivian's father closed his eyes and, bringing his hand to his heart, made a sound. Gamache, sitting across from him, watched closely. It wasn't clear if Homer was sighing or moaning, whether he was relieved or having a heart attack. Armand noticed that the hand over his heart was crunched into a fist, but not tight, not in pain, at least not physical pain. His heart, under attack for days, might just, with the news of the imminent arrest of Carl Tracy, finally be fighting back.
"I know you're not messing with me, Armand, but I need to hear it again. You're arresting him for what he did."
"Yes, I'll be going with Chief Inspector Beauvoir. We'll be bringing him in probably within the hour. You're free to go, but Homer..." It was the first time he'd used the man's first name to his face. "I'd like Agent Cloutier to drive you back to Three Pines."
"To get my things?"
"No, to stay with us, just for a few days. You shouldn't be alone."
"No, I want to go home. I need to be with..."
He made a vague gesture.
"Alone."
Armand knew he'd feel the same way, if Annie, if Renmarie, if Daniel. It was instinctive. A badly wounded animal crawling off alone to lick wounds, or, if they proved too deep, to die. Gamache had seen it more than once. People died from grief. Carl Tracy had killed the daughter. Gamache was damned if he'd let him kill the father, too. "You don't have to be social, but you shouldn't be alone." Armand leaned forward and touched Homer's hand, lightly, and whispered, "Please." He saw Agent Cloutier bristle a bit, perhaps annoyed that it was not she who was comforting Homer. But that's why Gamache had asked her to drive Homer down to Three Pines, so that Homer would have the company of someone he knew and trusted, someone he felt comfortable with. It might even be the bonding experience they both needed.
"I can leave your place whenever I want?"
Homer asked.
"And go home?"
"Yes, of course," said Armand. "Lisette will stay with you until I get there." That served several purposes. It kept Homer company, kept him there, and kept Renmarie safe. Armand doubted Homer would lash out again, but he wasn't going to take that chance.
"You're going to arrest him?"
It was the third time Homer had asked, and the third time Armand had said yes. And he was happy to say it all day and into the night. Yes. Yes. Carl Tracy would face a judge and jury for what he did to Vivian. Carl Tracy would spend the rest of his life in prison.
"And he'll be convicted? You promise?"
Gamache hesitated for a moment. "There's one more piece of evidence that will seal it. Someone's testimony." Godin's eyes widened in surprise.
"Someone was there? They saw what happened?"
"No, there are no actual witnesses. Though there rarely are. A case is built from evidence, and we have plenty. But this last piece would guarantee a conviction."
"You promise?"
Annie's father stood up and put out his hand to Vivian's father,
I promise.
Homer took it, then leaned forward very slowly, as did Armor, until their foreheads touched. They stayed there for the briefest of moments, eyes closed. Then Homer pulled back and caught his breath, wiping his face with his sleeve.
Sorry, out of Kleenex.
Here, said Lisette, offering a box she'd plucked from a nearby desk. Homer took it without really noticing who was attached to the offering.
Merci.
Ready? Asked Armor. Homer blew his nose, then stooped to pick up all the balled-up tissues he'd dropped on the floor. Leave them, said Armor. But the large man would not, could not, leave a mess for someone else to clean up. Chapter 29. Jean-Guy Beauvoir sat behind the wheel of the unmarked car. By tradition, the senior officer rode in the passenger seat, but Beauvoir could not bring himself to do that while Gamache was in the vehicle, except that once, when he was too exhausted to drive. Now they sat side by side, as they had for years, watching the home of a murder suspect, waiting for word from Lacoste, waiting to give the word to go.
What do you mean you're staying the night? Demanded Clara.
Sorry, but my flight from Burlington to New York was cancelled, Dominica oddly said.
What she didn't say was that she herself had cancelled it, and spoken to the big gay guy about a room at their bed and breakfast, or, as he insisted on calling it, bed and brunch. If their B&B looked like their bistro and tasted like the bakery, she really might never leave. She did not tell Clara that. The woman already looked like her hair was on fire.
"Can't you stay over in Burlington?" asked Clara, her voice rising. "Close to the airport?"
"Too late," said Gabri, dropping a key into Dominica's hand. "She's booked in. The Basquiat suite."
"Since when do you name your rooms?"
Clara all but hissed at him.
"Since she showed up," said Gabri, unapologetically. "And if you're not careful, we'll call the public bathroom the Toilette Clara Morrow."
"You know what she's just posted online about my works," said Clara,
watching as Ruth and Myrna joined the critic at the bistro fireplace. Renmarie had gone home, feeling the need for a long shower after watching those vile videos. Gabri turned to face Clara, his expression no longer a little goofy.
"I do. And now you have 24 hours you didn't have before to change her mind."
"She won't change her mind."
They walked over to the bar, and while Clara helped herself to a licorice pipe from the jar, Gabri poured her a red wine.
"You don't know that?" he smiled and touched her hand. "People do change. Minds change. I know you know that."
Clara turned and glared at Dominica oddly, now laughing and chatting with her best friend and her mentor. In her seat, by the fireplace. She felt the bile grow, felt the subtle demonisms of thought take hold. Lisette had tried to engage Homer in casual conversation, but, understandably, the only thing he was interested in hearing about was their investigation. Lisette wasn't really sure how much to tell him, but suspected he would not pass any of it along. And it would be public knowledge anyway, as soon as Tracy was arraigned. Besides, she was desperate to connect with him, to let him know the important role she'd played in having Tracy arrested, to let him know she wasn't just on his side, but by his side. In the 20-minute drive from Cowansville to Three Pines, she'd been debating how much to reveal, not just about the case against Tracy, but about herself, about her feelings. It was just dumb luck that Chief Inspector Gamache had given her this time alone with Homer. He couldn't possibly know what it meant to her, but now she needed to actually use it. They were getting closer and closer to Three Pines. Now was the time. But what should she say? She couldn't just blurt out, "I love you." Or could she? Maybe he needed to hear it, especially now, to know someone loved him, deeply. Just before cresting the hill that would take them down into Three Pines, she reached over and placed her hand on top of his. He didn't pull away. As they arrived at the Gamache home, just before putting the car in park, she squeezed,
And he, she was pretty sure, squeezed back.
Jean-Guy checked his phone again. It was instinctive. There were, as he already knew from the last time he checked, no bars, no reception. Which was why he'd chosen a car with a radio connecting them to the station. Now he stared at the handset, while beside him Gamache stared out the window, into the twilight, through the trees to the lonely home and the single light at a single window. Jean-Guy checked his phone again.
That's not true.
It is. The coroner just confirmed it. That baby was Carl's, Lacoste leaned forward. A little girl, his daughter.
Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it, Pauline?
Pauline was silent, but Lacoste could see her mind whirring. Superintendent Lacoste had another question for Pauline Vachon.
Where were you on Saturday afternoon and evening?
Homer knelt and put his face against the smelly old dog, rubbing him, mumbling to him, before standing back up.
Armand called to say you were coming, said Renmarie,
standing at the door, as Henri and Gracie ran out to greet the new arrivals.
I'm glad.
She was freshly showered and had put on slacks and a soft sweater. She turned to Agent Cloutier.
I have soup and sandwiches in the kitchen. You must be hungry.
She was.
Yes, please. Merci.
As they entered the home, Homer stepped closer to Renmarie, looking at her face. Then he shook his head.
I did that, he said, pointing to the bruise. I can't believe it. I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me.
I do, she said. And I think you showed amazing restraint. I shouldn't have tried to stop you. I'd have ripped the head off anyone who tried to stop me.
If it had been Annie dragged from the river, or Daniel, or Armand, she'd have done far worse to anyone standing between her and them.
Your room is waiting for you. Would you like to freshen up, then meet us in the kitchen?
He nodded, and the two women watched as he slowly climbed the stairs, followed, slowly, by Fred.
Homer,
said Lisette, not sure what to do.
I'll be fine, Lisette.
Even something as small as hearing him say her name thrilled her.
Chief Inspector, this is Cameron.
Beauvoir snatched the mouthpiece off its cradle and pressed the button. Oui? Gamache turned to watch, holding Beauvoir's eyes.
We have the warrant for Tracy's arrest.
Beauvoir exhaled. They had it. But he wanted more.
Is Superintendent Lacoste still in the interview room?
Yes.
Tell her to call as soon as she comes out. He went to replace the handset, but Gamache stopped him.
I have an idea.
Hold on, Cameron, said Beauvoir, and clicked the handset off while Gamache explained. Beauvoir nodded approval, then clicked the handset back on. Still there, Cameron?
Oui, patron.
This is what I want you to do.
Agent Cameron knocked on the door, then entered. Lacoste glanced at him with some annoyance. It was unusual to be interrupted in the middle of what was proving a difficult interrogation. Pauline Vachon was holding unexpectedly firm. She would not admit that Tracy planned to kill his wife, and that that's what the posts were about. Cameron bent down and whispered in her ear, then left. Lacoste smiled and turned back to Vachon, who was watching her with feigned boredom. But after a few seconds of silence, Vachon's brows lowered.
What?
She demanded.
I probably shouldn't tell you this, but an arrest warrant has just been issued for Carl Tracy, for the murder of Vivien Godin. Chief Inspector Beauvoir is bringing him in. He'll be here in half an hour.
Lacoste got up and, collecting the papers, closed the file.
Can I go now?
Not quite yet. I want to hear what Monsieur Tracy has to say. Then you can go. She walked to the door and stopped when she heard that one word, that beautiful word.
Wait.
The radio crackled, and Jean-Guy reached for it so quickly it bobbled out of his hand. He juggled it for a moment before finally grasping it.
Beauvoir?
We have him, said Isabelle Lacoste. Pauline Vachon just admitted they'd discussed killing Vivien, that Tracy planned to do it.
She'll sign the statement,
testify against him?
Yes.
They knocked on the door. By now it was dark. Not even the porch light was on, though there was still the one light on, upstairs. They knocked again. Still no answer. Beauvoir turned to the two uniformed Sûreté agents and signalled them to go around back. Then he and Gamache exchanged glances. Beauvoir turned the handle of the front door. It was unlocked. He swung it open.
Tracy? Carl Tracy? Beauvoir called. Sûreté, we have a warrant for your arrest.
He walked in, slowly, carefully, with Gamache right beside him. Both seasoned officers scanned the room, looking for a killer. They found him passed out, drunk, on the bed, in a puddle of his own vomit. Chapter 30. The arraignment was held the next morning, in Superior Court at the Palais de Justice in Montreal. Once he'd sobered up, Carl Tracy had been given a shower and a change of clothes. He spent the night at the Cowansville detachment, where he'd been booked for murder. From there, early in the morning, he'd been driven to a cell in the Montreal courthouse. Chief Inspectors Beauvoir and Gamache met there first thing and interviewed him with his court-appointed lawyer present. Predictably, his lawyer told him not to say anything. Equally predictably, Tracy couldn't help but talk. After Tracy claimed he had nothing to do with Vivian's death, Beauvoir presented him with Pauline Vachon's statement. "She says you talked about killing your wife," Tracy snorted.
"Who doesn't say that every now and then?"
"I don't," said Chief Inspector Beauvoir.
"You will."
Beauvoir knew he shouldn't let this man get up his nose, but Tracy was firmly lodged there. That smug, weaselly look from a man who'd just killed his wife and unborn child. "You know nothing," Beauvoir began.
"Chief Inspector," said Gamache, a warning in his voice.
Carl Tracy turned to Gamache.
"I wouldn't kill my own wife. Too obvious. But someone else's. That was your wife in that village, right? Looks like you and I have something in common. That bruise on her face."
Gamache grew very still, very quiet. Then he turned back to Beauvoir, who was staring, dumbfounded by what Tracy just said. The lawyer ended the session there. Beauvoir and Gamache walked down the hallway. Finally, Gamache spoke.
"He'll confess."
"You think?"
"Oui. He's a foolish, weak man. If he doesn't actually mean to confess, he'll incriminate himself with his bravado. He'll hang himself."
"If only."
Gamache glanced at Beauvoir, but said nothing.
They stood as the judge took her seat. The prosecutor, with Chief Inspector Beauvoir beside him, was on one side of the courtroom, Tracy and his lawyer on the other. Gamache and Agent Cloutier sat immediately behind the prosecution desk, with Homer Godin between them. Behind them sat Simone Fleury, with at least 20 other women. Young, middle-aged, elderly, stony-faced. Valkyries, warrior fates, magnificent and terrifying. Gamache caught Madame Fleury's eye. She nodded. The seats behind Tracy were empty. Barry Zalmanowitz, a prosecutor they knew well, had been given the case. He was feeling confident enough to kid Gamache when the Sûreté officers showed up at his office.
"I see you're trending, Armand. Of course, I knew the video was faked. You're not that good a shot."
He smiled, obviously trying, with a spectacular lack of success, to lighten the mood. Seeing the grim look on Chief Inspector Gamache's face and the anger on Beauvoir's, the prosecutor dropped his voice and added,
"I also saw the real thing. I can't believe it was posted again. I'm sorry. I hope they find out who did that. Someone calling themselves dumbass."
"We have an idea," said Beauvoir. He'd stayed away from Three Pines, not wanting to see Ruth, not wanting to say things that could never be taken back. He knew that the elderly woman actually meant well, but in true Ruth fashion, she'd managed to inflict a wound, and this one went deep. Before the proceeding started, Beauvoir had pulled Vivian's father aside and said, "This won't take long. The judge will ask Tracy how he pleads."
"What will he say?"
We think his plea will be not guilty. Beauvoir waited for the outburst, but there was none. Monsieur Godin, in the past 12 hours, had managed to harness his emotions, though Beauvoir could see it was a struggle. Gamache had prepared the man the night before, as much as possible, for what would happen. Carl Tracy would be led in. He'd sit at a distance from them, but Godin would certainly see him.
"Will you be able to control yourself?" Gamache had asked.
"I think so."
Gamache had paused before speaking again.
"If you don't think you can, then you shouldn't go. If there's an outburst, you'll be thrown out, or even arrested. You'll do yourself and the case no favours."
Homer had glanced into the fire, mesmerised by the liquid flames. It was just the two of them now, and Fred the dog. They'd had dinner in the kitchen with Reine-Marie and Lisette Cloutier. It was a simple meal of lentil soup and thick-cut fresh bread, warm from the oven, and cheese. Homer managed a few spoonsful and finished off one piece of bread with melted butter. Now they sat alone in the restful room, with coffee and a plate of untouched chocolate chip cookies. Reine-Marie had gone to bed, Henri and Gracie trailing along behind her. Agent Cloutier had driven back to Montreal.
"I'll control myself," said Homer.
Gamache studied the man and nodded. He wasn't completely convinced Godin would do it, or that it was even possible. But he also knew there was no way to prevent Vivian's father from being there when Carl Tracy was arraigned for Vivian's murder. Homer had to face his daughter's killer. They talked into the night, about Vivian, about her mother, about everything except what had happened. Finally, at just after 2 in the morning, Godin fell silent. After a few minutes, he got up.
"I think I'm ready for bed."
He looked at Armand.
"I've never had a brother, not even a close man friend. No, a lot of guys, but we never really talk. Now I wonder why not."
He paused and gathered himself before speaking again.
"This has helped."
"I'm glad."
Gamache slept lightly, listening for the sound of restless footsteps. But finally Homer had to be woken from a deep sleep at 6:30.
"There's coffee and breakfast, if you'd like,"
Armand had said after poking his head in the door and seeing a groggy Homer.
"Then we need to drive in."
And now they sat in the courtroom, the early April, late morning sun struggling through the grimy windows. Homer ran his hands, shaking a little, through his short grey hair, and then jerked when there was a sound off to their left, a door opening. He reached out and grabbed Armand's arm, as a passenger on a suddenly doomed aircraft would reach for the person in the next seat. Gamache turned with him, as did everyone else, and watched as Carl Tracy, in handcuffs, was led in. Homer rose to his feet and stood stock still, face immobile, hands clenched at his sides, eyes fastened on his former son-in-law, willing Tracy, daring him to look in his direction. But Tracy did not. Homer stared, in a pose so contained, so dignified, so stoic, it both amazed Gamache and bruised his heart. Armand had also gotten to his feet to stand with Homer, and now the others joined them as the bailiff announced,
"Silence, all rise, please. The Superior Court is now in session. The Honourable Caroline Pelletier presiding."
The judge, in long black robes, entered. With a signal, everyone in the courtroom sat back down, except Godin.
"Homer," whispered Gamache, getting back up and touching, slightly tugging, his arm.
The man, roused from a sort of trance, sat, but continued to glare at Tracy. The rustling stopped as Judge Pelletier got herself organised, and then there was silence, one that went on and on. Gamache's face revealed nothing, but he grew wary, alert. This protracted pause was unusual. He knew the judge. She was strict, no nonsense, not chummy or clubby. She brooked no informality and no bending of the rules or the interpretation of the law. She was, in his opinion, a great jurist. But now she was looking down at her papers, shuffling them a bit. instead of doing what she should have been doing, which was to have the charges read and ask the defendant how he pleads. It was rote, routine, something they went through all the time, clear, simple. Tracy would be remanded for trial, led away, and that would be it. Except, out of the corner of his eye, Gamache could see Beauvoir stirring. The prosecuting attorney was staring intently at the judge. Beauvoir turned in his seat and mouthed, "What's up?" Something was up. Something was wrong. Judge Caroline Pelletier looked out at the courtroom. Her heart sank when she saw the women ranged behind Chief Inspector Gamache. She knew who they were and why they were there. She intentionally skimmed past the man beside Monsieur Gamache. She assumed it was the victim's father. Judge Pelletier did not want to catch his eye. Instead, her gaze moved to the defence table and rested on the man sitting next to his lawyer, the defendant, Carl Tracy. Judge Pelletier had been up most of the night, going over and over the file, the evidence. She knew it was folly and ethically wrong to prejudge, but judges were, after all, human, and some cases were just obvious. There was very little doubt in her mind who had killed Vivian Godin, nor was there much doubt about the outcome of the day. Still, to be sure, she'd called up colleagues and asked opinions, then asked more colleagues, judges across the country, and collected more opinions. She'd even phoned her old, now retired, law prof and gone through the case against Carl Tracy. All, save one, said the same thing. And now it was her turn to say it.
"There is, I'm afraid, a poisonous tree in this case."
Jean-Guy Beauvoir stared at the judge in amazement, then turned to the prosecutor. Zalmanowicz's mouth had fallen open. Beauvoir swiveled to look at Gamache, whose eyes were wide, his mouth also slightly open.
"It goes back to the very beginning," said Judge Pelletier,
her voice almost a monotone.
"Even before Vivian Godin's body was found."
"What's she saying?"
asked Homer, his voice below normal conversation but above a whisper.
"What does this mean?"
He could tell, a child could tell, that something unexpected had just happened. Something bad.
"What's a poisonous tree?"
"In a minute," whispered Gamache, glancing briefly at Homer before returning his attention to the judge.
"When Vivian Godin's overnight bag was found on the shores of the river," Judge Pelletier turned to Beauvoir, "you did not have a warrant, I believe, to go onto that private property."
Beauvoir shot to his feet. "No, Your Honour, we didn't. But it was an emergency. The river was in flood, and it needed to be diverted. The law allows us to enter private property in an emergency. We don't need a warrant to rescue people from a fire, for example."
"True, but in going onto private property, you didn't just create a runoff for the flood. You discovered the victim's duffel bag. Did you open it?"
"We did." Judge Pelletier nodded.
"Oui, that's what it says here."
She placed her hand on the papers in front of her.
"There's video evidence of that too, which has been submitted. Your written statement says that upon opening it and examining the contents, you realised it belonged to the missing woman, which led you to the bridge, which led you to her body."
"What's happening?"
Godin whispered more urgently.
"Just listen,"
said Gamache, keeping his voice low, calm, reasonable. He reached over and touched the man's arm, feeling it so tense it might snap. His own body was taut. He could see where this was going, though he barely believed it.
A poisonous tree? Surely not.
He'd become hyper-aware of his surroundings. The world was bright and in sharp focus. Sounds were magnified, the smallest movement noted, every word, every inflection absorbed. It was the way he became when under attack, for this felt like an attack, like someone had just tossed a grenade into the courtroom. And there was nothing he could do to stop it from going off. Off to the side, at the defence desk, he could see the court-appointed lawyer equally surprised. But unlike the prosecution, who was looking at the judge as though he'd been hit in the face, the defence was smiling. Zalmanowicz, the prosecuting attorney, got to his feet.
If it pleases the court, there's case law covering this. Where officers go onto private property to stop a crime being committed, and in the course of that come across another crime.
True? The judge stopped him there with an upraised hand, predicting just this objection. But no crime was being committed. A river was flooding. It was an act of nature. A violent one, potentially dangerous, granted. I have no doubt that the actions of the officers saved property, if not lives. It was the right thing to do. Except when they found the duffel bag, they should have immediately applied for a warrant before removing it, and certainly before opening it.
Beauvoir, in near panic, looked once again at Gamache. Gamache himself was shocked. Never had he heard such a severe, such a narrow interpretation of the law. He immediately scribbled on a piece of paper and handed it to the prosecution, who read it and said,
Your Honour, a life was at stake. As you said, Madame Gaudin had not yet been found. She could have been hurt or kidnapped. They needed to search the overnight bag to determine if it was hers and if it could lead them to her, which it did.
And that might have been justified, said the judge, had they not been on the defendant's private property. Let me ask you this. Did the officers get Mr. Tracy's permission before opening the bag?
The prosecution turned to Beauvoir, who had gone so pale his lips were almost white. He thought and thought, glancing at Gamache once. Beauvoir was not pausing to remember, Gamache knew. He remembered perfectly well, as did Gamache. Carl Tracy shouting at them not to open the duffel bag, that it was none of their business. No, Jean-Guy Beauvoir was pausing to decide whether or not to tell the truth. Judge Pelletier was giving them a potential out, a way to cut down the poisonous tree, whose roots and branches and fruit looked to infect so much of their case against Tracy.
While not formally sworn in, Chief Inspector, the judge said, you are presumed under oath.
She could see his thoughts, his struggle, and it seemed clear to Gamache that she sympathised. This was not giving Judge Pelletier any pleasure, but it was, according to her lights, the law. Before Beauvoir could answer, the defence got to his feet.
Your Honour, my client tells me he told them.
Tracy grabbed his arm, and the lawyer bent down to listen to his client, then straightened up.
He begged them not to open the bag. But they did anyway.
I see, said the judge. Just out of interest's sake, why didn't he want the police to open the bag? If it could have helped them find his wife, which, presumably, he wanted.
That was met with silence. It was a very good question. Both Gamache and Beauvoir would have been amused by Tracy's bringing this scrutiny on himself, had they themselves not been so appalled by what was happening. The lawyer consulted his client, then turned to the judge.
He says he believed his wife was alive and that the bag contained things she wouldn't want strangers to see, like underwear.
Oh, for Christ's sake,
burst out of Homer.
You're not... You can't... This is...
Homer, said Gamache, turning to him, but Gaudin was already on his feet. Gamache also rose and faced Homer, who was glaring at Tracy with all the violence a look could contain. Then Gamache turned to the judge.
Please, Your Honour, he said.
For you, Monsieur Gamache, I will give you a moment to settle him. I'm assuming that is the young woman's father?
He is, and thank you.
Gamache turned back to Homer.
Do you need to leave? Look at me.
He stood between Homer and Tracy, breaking Homer's line of sight, forcing Homer to focus on him.
You need to hold it together.
Gamache was speaking so quietly that no one else could hear, and so forcefully that Gaudin would not just hear, but listen.
Or you need to leave. Do you understand?
Gaudin nodded.
Do you want to stay?
Gaudin nodded.
And you'll control yourself, no matter what happens?
What is happening, Armour?
The man's voice now sounded almost like that of a child.
I don't know, but losing control will only make it worse. You understand?
You promised. You promised it would be okay.
Please, said Gamache, just sit down.
Homer sat, and Gamache turned to the judge and gave a nod that was almost a small bow.
Merci.
The judge looked tired, strained. Even, Gamache thought, a little sad, which did not bode well. She turned back to Beauvoir.
You still haven't answered my question, Chief Inspector.
Beauvoir got back to his feet.
No, Your Honour, we didn't ask, and the defendant did not give us permission to open the bag.
I see.
She gestured to him to sit back down. As he did, he glanced at Gamache, who nodded approval. A lie would make this even worse. Besides, there was the video Renmarie had taken at his request.
The opening of the bag is, in my opinion, a poisonous tree, said Judge Pelletier. And everything that stems from that act is its fruit, and therefore tainted and inadmissible.
The prosecutor leaped up.
I object!
Speaking more forcefully than was perhaps wise.
Noted, said Judge Pelletier. Are we in trouble?
Agent Cloutier leaned across Homer to whisper to Gamache.
We're all right. We have Pauline Vachon's signed statement. That didn't stem from the discovery of the duffel bag.
Right. Good.
Now, said Judge Pelletier, no longer looking up at them, on to the other issue.
The world seemed to stop for Gamache.
Other issue?
He could feel, almost hear, his heart throbbing. Everything, everyone else, seemed to recede, except the judge. He was completely, totally focused, and when she next spoke, it was as though her words were deposited directly and uniquely into his head.
The statement by Madame Vachon. I've considered this, and consulted colleagues across the country, many of whom are beginning to form judgments on the issue of social media and boundaries.
What's she saying? Hissed Beauvoir. My God, she's not.
But he couldn't continue. Couldn't conceive that.
The boundaries of a person's house are clear, said the judge. The property line, the front door. A warrant is needed to cross. A warrant is needed to tap into a phone and listen to private conversations, to read private emails. But the very notion, even the name, of social media confuses issues of trespass. How can something social, public, be trespassed? There are limits, of course. Laws against hate speech, pornography. But even those are unclear, blurry. When is social media private and when is it public? Pauline Vachon and her relationship to Carl Tracy were discovered after a sûreté officer tricked Madame Vachon into giving her access to her private Instagram account.
Agent Cloutier's eyes opened wide.
What?
Oh, my God, whispered Beauvoir. Armand, said Homer, what's this?
The judge had not raised her head, would not look their way, and appeared to be reading now from notes.
There's not much jurisprudence on this as yet, but the vast majority of jurists I consulted agreed that in posing as Nouveau Galerie, it was the equivalent of a robber posing as an electrician to gain access to a private residence, under false pretenses, with the intent to compromise the occupant.
The prosecution shot to his feet.
I object. That isn't the correct analogy.
And what is?
Undercover operations, snapped Salmanowitz. A police officer posing as someone they are not in order to gain evidence in a criminal case.
Yes, I did consider that, said Judge Pelletier. Except there was, as yet, no reason to suspect Madame Vachon of anything criminal.
Monsieur Tracy, perhaps, but as soon as Agent Cloutier realized she was corresponding with this Pauline Vachon, she should have disengaged. Instead, she tricked Madame Vachon into giving her access to an account that led to not just evidence of an affair, but to those incriminating posts. Judge Pelletier turned to Carl Tracy. With her voice flat, she began to speak.
Armand Gamache held his breath. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Monsieur Tracy, I'm having the charges against you dropped. You're free to go.
No!
Gaudin shot to his feet, as did Gamache. He reached for Homer and braced himself, but was still propelled backward as Vivian's father exploded forward,
toward Tracy. There was sudden mayhem as chairs and benches were knocked over. Guards ran to yank the judge off the dais and into the back room. People fell over, and others joined the fight to stop an inconsolable, uncontainable father. Gamache felt his feet go out from under him and fell backward, dragging Homer down with him. They landed in a pile on the marble floor. There was an eerie silence, then the squealing of overturned chairs being shoved aside as arms and legs reassembled themselves into individual people. There were moans and groans, orders issued by guards and cops. Beauvoir, who'd leaped over the railing to try to stop Homer, now rolled off the man's back and tried to get air back into his own lungs.
"Armand,"
he gasped.
"Okay. You?"
"Oui."
Gamache freed his legs and, scrambling to his knees, bent over Homer's inert body. So still was the man that Gamache felt for a pulse, then laid down, his cheek on the cold marble floor, face to face, their noses almost touching.
"Homer."
His eyes were closed, and Armand noticed blood on the floor.
"Get an ambulance."
A court officer ran to make the call. Beauvoir was keeping the guards away, explaining the man wasn't armed, wasn't a danger. Homer's eyes fluttered, then opened, and focused on Armand.
"You promised,"
he whispered.
Chapter 31. Vivian's father was taken by ambulance to the Hôtel Dieu hospital. Gamache had wanted to go with him, but sent Cloutier and Cameron instead. It had been Bob Cameron who'd finally brought Gordon down. He'd come into the courtroom late, standing unnoticed at the back, as the judge had given her reasoning and conclusion. And when Homer had burst forward, Cameron had instantly seen what was happening and what needed to be done. The left tackle did what he'd been trained to do. He'd run into the fray, diving at the last minute, using his body to sweep Gaudin's legs out from under him, and, in so doing, also tackling Gamache and Beauvoir and Cloutier and anyone else hanging on to Vivian's father.
"Give me a few minutes,"
Zalmanowitz, the prosecutor, said to the Sûreté officers once the ambulance had left and order had been restored.
"I'll speak to the judge. Then we can talk."
Judge Pelletier had decided not to charge Monsieur Gaudin, clearly sympathizing with the man, the father.
"Merde, merde, merde," muttered Beauvoir.
"Merde,"
uttered Lacoste. She'd been in another interview, to possibly take over command of public security, when word had reached her about what had happened in the courthouse. She'd hurried over, and now the three of them walked along the slushy cobblestone streets outside the courthouse, in need of fresh air and to try to clear their heads.
"A shit show. What the fuck was that?"
Beauvoir stopped, took a deep breath, closed his eyes, then opened them again.
"Sorry, but really, what the fuck was that?"
They circled the building in Old Montreal, feeling the sun on their hot faces and the fresh air in their lungs. They spoke a little, mostly curses from Beauvoir. Gamache, who had said almost nothing since the judge's pronouncement, let them vent, while he walked and considered. Then they all fell silent, lost in their own thoughts, the same thoughts, partly about what had gone wrong, mostly how to fix it. Beauvoir's phone buzzed, a text from Zalmanowitz, as terse as the man. "Meet me in my office." The three Sûreté officers were around the back of the building, but Gamache knew the way in, past the trash and recycling bins. After he'd pressed the button and stared into the camera, the door was unlocked. It helped that Gamache knew the guards by name, and they knew him, after decades of trials and tribulations. Beauvoir and Lacoste followed Gamache along grimy, ill-lit corridors. Taking the service elevator, they finally emerged into the gleaming marble hallway, the public face hiding the smelly, dark underbelly of justice.
"Well, that was a clusterfuck of a decision," said Zalmanowitz, not bothering to get up or even look up from his laptop as they entered. "I spoke to Judge Pelletier, who walked me through it."
"And?" asked Beauvoir.
"And we'll appeal, of course," said the prosecutor.
"Will we win?"
"Hard to say."
"Try."
Now Zalmanowicz gave them his complete attention, turning from his screen.
Honestly? I doubt it. As much as we hate the decision, Judge Pelletier did her due diligence, even canvassing jurists across the country.
But a poisonous tree, interrupted Beauvoir. Come on.
I know. I can't explain her interpretation. Well, I can, but it's an incredibly narrow view of the law.
He rubbed his eyes and sighed. Then, looking up, he smiled weakly.
You know what they say about lawyers?
Gamache gave Beauvoir a warning glance.
That we're like children in the dark, imagining all the monsters.
It was, Gamache knew, a pretty apt description of his job, too.
Seems I missed one, said the lawyer. Two, really?
We all did, said Beauvoir. Zalmanowicz nodded his thanks for sharing the blame.
Judge Pelletier had latitude. It could have gone the other way, and I think she genuinely struggled with it. Especially since, as she privately told me, our case was a lock.
Beauvoir's hand slammed down on the wooden arms of his chair, and he growled,
Jesus!
Getting up, he paced the room, trying to blow off the pent-up frustration. The others let him pace until he'd regained control of himself. Sitting back down, he didn't apologize, but he did look directly at Zalmanowicz and say,
Someone needs to make sure Tracy gets what's coming to him. We're trying. Try harder. Look, you're the ones who opened that duffel bag, he said, his voice rising, his frustration getting away from him with every word. Who let an inexperienced agent loose to goose-step around in that Instagram account?
Zalmanowicz stopped himself, with effort, putting his hands out in front of him as though to protect them from his wrath. He sat back in his chair, which bounced with the force of his body. Staring at Gamache, he saw that while the chief inspector's tone had been civil so far, and his face calm, his jaw muscles were clamped tight. This was not a relaxed man. This was a man who was simply better at containing his emotions.
I'm sorry.
Zalmanowicz took a deep breath and looked at the three investigators.
This isn't your fault.
Of course it is, snapped Beauvoir. I fucked up.
So did I, said Gamache. I'm the one who actually opened the duffel bag.
And I let Agent Cloutier pursue the Instagram account. Even encouraged her, said Lacoste, shaking her head.
None of us looks good in this, Zalmanowicz admitted. I'm the lawyer, the prosecutor. I should have seen that there might be a problem, but I didn't.
Now he rubbed his face with his hands, trying to erase his expression of defeat.
That is true. This is mostly your fault, said Beauvoir.
And when the prosecutor looked at him, Beauvoir smiled, and Zalmanowicz gave one gruff laugh. Truce.
As I said, I'll file an appeal, said the prosecutor. But that'll take months to be heard. The poisonous tree is the most damaging ruling. It's just unfortunate that so much stems from something so early on. It affects almost every bit of evidence.
Unfortunate isn't the word, said Lacoste.
Zalmanowicz nodded. Her decision on the poisonous tree sits right on the boundary, which is why no other judge will overturn her ruling. And you'd better note it, because it'll become case law from now on, and affect all other searches. But,
now he leaned forward, arms on his desk,
the more gnarly decision, by her own private admission, concerns the social media issue.
The Instagram account, said Lacoste, pulling her chair closer to the desk.
Exactly. Judge Pelletier's right, of course, that courts are struggling to figure out the laws around social media. The government's working on legislation, but it's controversial and sensitive. And you know how politicians love those two things.
He waited for their laugh of appreciation. Instead, all he got were three glum stares.
If this judgment stands, he went on, it'll redefine boundaries.
But it's not right, said Beauvoir. It ties our hands when it comes to social media accounts. It pretty much locks us out and lets people do anything they want.
As they can in the privacy of their own homes, said Zalmanowicz. That's the analogy she's using. As Pierre Elliott Trudeau said when he was Prime Minister, the government has no place in the bedrooms of the nation.
But there are limits, said Gamache. Assault, child pornography, murder. Just because people do it in the privacy of their homes doesn't mean they're beyond the reach of law. But I also know we aren't solving anything by going over and over this. A decision was reached. You'll appeal. In the meantime, Carl Tracy is free. Do we have other evidence, untainted, that can be used?
Vivian called her father that day to say she was finally leaving Tracy, said Beauvoir. That sure suggests she was afraid.
There's the evidence of Agent Cameron, who responded to Vivian's 911 calls, said Lacoste. It was clear there was abuse.
But not clear enough for him to actually bring Tracy in. He didn't feel it met the reasonable suspicion test. Besides, abuse isn't murder. What else do we have?
There's that young man, what's his name? Said Beauvoir. The one she called over and over the day she was killed.
Gerald Bertrand, said Lacoste. He claims it was a wrong number.
And you believe him? Asked Zalmanowitz.
Yes, I think I do. We checked him out, and there's absolutely nothing connecting him to Vivian or Tracy. I think she wrote the number down wrong.
What number was she calling again? Asked Gamache.
Lacoste gave it to him.
I don't understand why, if she was so afraid, she didn't ask her father to come get her, said Zalmanowitz. He offered, said Gamache, but she said it was too dangerous, that she had to choose her time carefully. So she feared for her life, said Zalmanowitz. She told her father that?
Gamache considered, remembering that first conversation with Godin in his home in Saint-Agathe.
Not specifically. I think she was afraid and let him know that, but not for her life. I think if she'd told him that, Monsieur Godin would have definitely gone to get her. He didn't want to make it worse or trigger any violence, so he stayed home. That poor man, said Zalmanowitz. How do you live with yourself?
There was no answering that.
So, said Zalmanowitz after a pause, Vivian was obviously afraid of her husband.
Oui, afraid of what he'd do if he knew she was leaving.
But wait a minute, Zalmanowitz raised his hand to stop Gamache. According to the girlfriend, Pauline Vachon, Tracy wanted to get rid of her. Wouldn't her leaving solve the problem, and then they wouldn't have to kill her? Why not just let her go? He didn't really have to kill her.
He might not have realised she planned to leave, said Beauvoir. He says she told him, but does that really seem likely?
It did not. So you think he killed her without knowing she was leaving anyway? Asked Zalmanowitz.
Even if he knew, Tracy still had a motive, said Gamache. He admitted to me he had no intention of giving half the home to her, or to support the child. He told them about his exchange in the kitchen when Tracy admitted that Vivian's leaving and taking half the farm with her was a pretty good motive.
So there's your answer, said Beauvoir. Tracy's violent, drunk, he planned to kill her, and he did. The fact she was going to leave anyway only drove him more crazy.
And the bag, asked Zalmanowitz. How did it get into the river? Who packed it?
We think Tracy did, said Beauvoir. Based on strange things in the bag and the private message to Vachon.
Stuff's in the bag, Lacoste read from her notes. Everything's ready. We'll be done tonight. I promise.
Zalmanowitz sighed. Damning. And completely inadmissible. But what I don't get is if she did plan to leave, like she told her father, why didn't she pack the bag? Oh, never mind. He flung himself back in the chair again and threw up his hands. It's all academic. The duffel bag is out of bounds. It's as though the bag never existed.
No, said Beauvoir. It's as though we didn't find it. But it happened. And now we need to find another way to get him. They looked at him. Beauvoir had climbed out of his outrage, more determined than ever, far from defeated.
They'd get Carl Tracy. Somehow.
The prosecutor leaned forward again, drew his notepad toward him, and picked up a pen.
Right. What we can use is Carl Tracy's first statement to you, the prosecutor said to Gamache. That was before the bag or the body was found.
And we have the first interview with Homer Godin, when Vivian was still missing, said Beauvoir. And we have the phone records that led us to Gerald Bertrand. They went back over and over those conversations. Tracy saying Vivian was drunk and abusive. Tracy claiming she was having affairs. that she told him the baby wasn't his and that she was leaving him, that she'd gone off with some lover. Tracy admitting to hitting her that Saturday night, and then going into his studio with a bottle, getting wasted and passing out. When he woke up, she was gone.
"Okay," said Zalmanowicz. "That's his version of what happened. We know it's all bullshit. How did he seem to you, Armand, when you first spoke to him?"
Gamache thought back. It seemed months ago now, not mere days.
"Belligerent, violent."
He described the pitchfork and the shouts to get off the property.
"Not very cooperative," said Zalmanowicz. "The one good moment from a shitty day was the judge asking Tracy why he didn't want you to open the duffel bag if he was so worried about his wife. It's a good question, a telling question. It must eat her up to have to release him. But you know, something's bothering me. After meeting Tracy and hearing more about him, I can understand him killing someone. What I don't understand is the method."
"How so?" asked Gamache.
"Wouldn't you expect this fellow to do something stupid and brutal?
Throwing his pregnant wife off a bridge to be battered and drowned in a freezing river isn't brutal enough for you?" asked Lacoste. Zalmanowicz regarded her.
"No, it's not. Given his history, I'd have expected something simpler, more hands-on. Beating her to death, shooting her, hitting her with a shovel and burying her. Why throw her off a bridge half a kilometre away?"
"Maybe it was Pauline Vachon's idea," said Lacoste. "She seems smart."
"No messages to support that it was her idea?"
"Where she suggests throwing Vivian off the bridge?" asked Lacoste. "Yes, but we decided not to show you." For one brief moment, Zalmanowicz believed her, then lowered his brows. "Of course they weren't," said Lacoste. "They must have come up with the plan when they were together. We've canvassed the neighbours. A few saw him entering her place last week. She says that was for business."
"Right," said the prosecutor. "And even if there were explicit posts describing it in detail, we couldn't use them, thanks to Nouveau Galerie and that agent."
"It wasn't her fault," Lacoste repeated. "Like I said, she ran it by me and I approved. Encouraged her even, so lay off her."
"Okay, sorry, you're right," said Zalmanowicz. "Back to the bridge. How did Tracy even get Vivian there?"
"The coroner thinks the most likely explanation is that he beat her senseless at home, put her in the car, and drove her to the bridge," said Beauvoir. "Her blood on the car handle and steering wheel might have come from her blood on his hands."
"But that doesn't explain his boot prints," said the prosecutor. "How would they get under the car if he drove her there?"
"Made when he was scouting the place, maybe," said Beauvoir. "We don't really know the details, and probably never will. Another possibility is that part of what Tracy said is true. Vivian arranged to meet her lover on the bridge. Tracy overheard and got there first."
"Okay," said Lacoste. "But then what happened to the lover? And when did she call him?"
"There were only 5 calls out of the house that day. 4 to what we think is the wrong number and 1 to her father."
"You said you believed Bertrand when he said he didn't know her," said Gamache. "Is it possible you were wrong?"
Lacoste considered.
"It's always possible."
Gamache nodded, even as he recognized it for what it was, desperation. But sometimes that uncovered something useful. And they had precious little left to them, except desperation.
"All right, let's walk through it," said the prosecutor. "Vivian is afraid. She calls her father, telling him she's leaving her husband but has to choose her time. That evening, Tracy beats her senseless, and then, either thinking she's dead or trying to work up the courage to finally kill her, he goes into his studio and gets drunk.
Then Vivian regains consciousness and calls Bertrand, her lover," said Beauvoir, "begging for help, telling him to meet her on the bridge. But this Bertrand fellow doesn't show up. She was a fling to him, nothing more. He sure didn't want to get involved with a pregnant woman running from a dangerous husband."
"Vivian gets in the car and drives herself there," said the prosecutor. "Bertrand doesn't show, but Tracy does. He's waiting for her. He throws her off the bridge and tosses the bag in. The one he'd already packed, according to the posts."
"There is another possibility," said Gamache.
They turned to him and he sat forward. that Bertrand did show up.
Go on, said Zalmanowitz.
Suppose Tracy didn't pack the bag, but Vivian did. Suppose she called Bertrand, telling him to meet her on the bridge.
Why there? Asked the prosecutor.
Maybe that's where they always met, said Gamache. She shows up and waits for him. As he spoke, the cold, dark April evening appeared before them. Vivian Godin, bruised from Tracy's latest and last beating, stands on the bridge. Bertrand's headlights appear down the disused dirt road, little more than a path. He gets out, and she tells him she's pregnant. Maybe even that the baby is his. She might have even believed it. Tells him she's leaving her abusive husband and needs his help. And then Bertrand snaps, sees his frat boy life changing completely. In panic, he pushes her backward, into the railing. It breaks, and, to his horror, she falls. Beauvoir, Lacoste, Zalmanowitz sat in silence, once again imagining Vivienne's face as she hung in the air between the bridge and the water, then disappeared. To cover his tracks, he throws her bag in after her, said Beauvoir.
Or maybe she had it in her hand or over her shoulder, said Lacoste, and it went in with her.
But what about Tracy's boot prints under Vivian's car? Asked Zalmanowitz.
Maybe they weren't Tracy's, said Gamache. It's a pretty common boot. Monsieur Béliveau even sells it in his general store in Three Pines, and it's a standard size for a man, 10.
Are you seriously suggesting that Carl Tracy did not kill his wife? Asked Zalmanowitz. But that this Gerald Bertrand did?
No, admitted Gamache. I'm just following possibilities. Things any defence would throw out there. I have no doubt that Tracy is the murderer. But there are questions.
Zalmanowitz was quiet, lost in thought, then looked at Gamache again.
Was he afraid?
I'm sorry?
Tracy, when you first went there to interview him about his missing wife, you said he was belligerent, but did he seem nervous? Afraid?
Gamache thought, then shook his head.
No,
nor did he seem concerned that his wife was missing, as any normal husband would be.
Or any husband smart enough to pretend, said Lacoste.
We're just running in place, said Zalmanowitz, going back over crumbs and trying to assemble a banquet. The only thing we know for sure, besides that Vivian was killed, is that she called her father that morning, then made 4 calls to what might or might not be a wrong number.
Shit. He threw down his pen.
All of this could have been avoided if she'd just asked her father to come get her. He's clearly the sort who would hold his own in a fight and would move heaven and earth to rescue her. And he sure wouldn't shy away from beating the shit out of her abusive husband. We saw that today.
As Zalmanowitz spoke, he continued to look at Gamache.
He reminds me a bit of you, Armand. You have a daughter about Vivian's age, don't you?
Annie, oui.
What would you do if you knew her husband was abusing her?
Armand raised his brows at Jean-Guy. Barry Zalmanowitz had obviously forgotten, or didn't know, that they were married.
I think it's best if I didn't answer that.
Then he grew serious.
What I can tell you is that Homer Godin confronted Tracy several times, but when it came down to it, Vivian always intervened and denied abuse. It's not clear if she was trying to protect her husband or her father, or, most likely, was afraid of another beating. Eventually, Tracy isolated her, as abusers often do, refusing to allow Homer to visit, refusing to allow Vivian to visit him.
In his statement, Tracy says it was Vivian who didn't want to see her father, said Zalmanowitz.
That's clearly a lie, said Beauvoir.
Obviously, but there's no one except Homer to contradict him, said Zalmanowitz. And, unfortunately, any statement by him could be seen as coloured by animus.
There is Lisette Cloutier, said Lacoste.
Who?
Asked Zalmanowitz.
Her name sounds familiar.
It would. She's the Sûreté agent who posed as Nouveau Galerie, said Lacoste. She's an old friend of the Godin family. It's because of her that we got on to Vivian being missing. Homer had asked for her help.
They're friends? Asked Zalmanowitz.
She was best friends with Homer's late wife,
Acosta explained. They stayed in touch.
And she's Vivian's godmother, said Gamache.
There seemed to be feelings there, between Agent Cloutier and Monsieur Godin, at least on Cloutier's part. It's unclear how Homer feels.
Hmm, said Zalmanowitz. Might be worth seeing if she can add anything.
I think if she could have added something, she would have, said Lacoste. But I'll ask. Again, they all recognized it for what it was. Desperation.
Any word from the hospital on Godin's condition?
Zalmanowitz asked.
There's no concussion, said Gamache. They're releasing him soon.
Good about the concussion thing, but now what? You know he'll try to...
Yes, we know, said Bovard with a sigh. That seemed to be the only thing they did know. I've put an agent on Tracy to protect him.
He actually felt his stomach sour as he said it, but he also remembered what Tracy had said in the interview room while looking directly at Gamache.
There's a restraining order on Godin, is that right? Asked Beauvoir, keeping him away from Tracy.
Yes, said Zalmanowitz. It was issued after that fracas in the courtroom.
I'd like one put on Carl Tracy as well, said Beauvoir, keeping him at a distance from Godin and from Three Pines.
Three Pines? Your village, Armand?
Zalmanowitz had been taking notes. Now he looked up at the man.
Oui, said Gamache. I doubt he was serious, but he threatened my wife.
Really? Jesus, he is stupid. Is it enough to arrest him?
No, it was vague, said Gamache.
He said he wouldn't kill his own wife, but someone else's, said Beauvoir, using the same upward inflection Tracy had used. He was looking at Monsieur Gamache as he spoke.
I see. I'll apply for a restraining order against Tracy,
Zalmanowitz made a note.
But we all know if someone really wants to do harm, a piece of paper won't stop them.
But a baseball bat, thought Gamache.
I take it Godin will be returning home, said Zalmanowitz.
I've asked the agents to bring him back to Three Pines, said Gamache. He can stay with us.
And if he doesn't want to? You can't force him, Armand, said Zalmanowitz.
Since when was it against the law to imprison another human being? Asked Armand. Oh, wait, I do remember something from my training.
Lacoste laughed, and Zalmanowitz smiled.
Okay, I get it. You know what you're doing. But you can't keep him there, even with his consent, forever. He'll want to leave eventually. And I doubt time will blunt his desire to kill the man who killed his daughter.
I doubt it too, said Gamache.
He took a deep breath, then sighed.
I'd hate to have to arrest him for that.
And I'd hate to have to prosecute him, said Zalmanowitz.
What would he get? Asked Beauvoir, out of interest's sake. The prosecutor thought about that.
He'd be charged with murder. His defence would probably say that he was not criminally responsible. Diminished capacity, brought on by extreme grief. If they're smart, his lawyers will try the case in front of a jury. He'd be convicted, probably of manslaughter, but wouldn't serve much time. A year, probably less. Maybe time served.
That's not so bad, said Beauvoir. Gamache was staring at him. He wasn't considering taking the protection away from Tracy, leaving the path clear for Godin to kill the man. Surely Jean Guy's last act as head of homicide would not be as an accessory to a homicide. They'd have to talk. Chief Inspector Beauvoir looked at Lacoste, then over to Gamache, and finally back to the prosecutor. We don't have enough evidence, untainted by the poisonous tree or the social media fiasco, to convict Tracy, do we?
No, said Zalmanowitz. Not even close. Unless you can find something else, we're screwed.
And Carl Tracy gets away with murder, said Lacoste.
Beauvoir got up and the others rose.
Merci. I'm sorry about this.
So am I. I'll put in the appeals. Even Judge Pelletier asked me to. She feels awful about it. I think she's more than half hoping she'll be overturned.
He walked them to the door and shook their hands. When it came to Gamache, he leaned in and whispered,
I'm sorry about the videos. Shitty day. I don't know if Dumbass has done you a favour or not, releasing the real video.
I know the answer to that, said Gamache.
Zalmanowitz nodded.
There is one more thing, Armand.
Oui?
Did you steal Tracy's dog?
Now both Beauvoir and Lacoste turned and stared, first at the prosecutor, then at Gamache.
I took Fred, yes, but I paid Tracy for him. Apparently not enough. He wants the dog back. He's filed a complaint.
You stole the dog? Beauvoir asked. I thought he came with Homer.
No, he was Vivian's dog. Tracy was going to shoot him, so I took him, and I'm not giving him back.
On this day of blurred boundaries, one clear line had to be drawn, and it seemed to have been drawn at the dog. They couldn't save Vivian. They might not even be able to save Homer. But they could save Fred. Barry Zalmanowicz stared at Gamache, then nodded.
I'll take care of it. Don't worry. Merci.
Now the prosecutor watched as the three of them, Gamache flanked by the two younger officers, walked down the corridor. And he remembered the images on the real video. Gamache, amid ferocious gunfire, dragging a critically wounded Beauvoir to safety, stanching the wound. Then having to leave him there and head back into the battle. Then, later in the tape, Isabel Lacoste was seen kneeling beside Gamache, holding his bloody hand as he lay, apparently dying, on the factory floor, shot in the head and chest. Now the three of them walked down the corridor, their feet echoing along a bright marble hall that hid so much stench below. And while the prosecutor didn't envy Armand Gamache anything about what was happening, with the case and with the social media attacks, he did envy him this. He watched until the three of them walked out the huge double doors and disappeared into the crisp April day. Once hit by the cold air, Beauvoir, as though slapped awake from a reverie,